I'm speaking with Stephanie Palmer, and she is author of Good in a Room, How to Sell Yourself and Your Ideas and Win Over Any Audience. Stephanie, how are you today?
Excellent.
Good. So what's the big idea here?
Well, the phrase good in a room describes anyone who presents themselves and their ideas effectively. And the phrase originated in Hollywood and is used by agents and producers to describe people who pitch their ideas well. And what I do is I teach people to use the tactics that work in Hollywood in their own industry.
So what's your background?
Well, I was the director of creative affairs at MGM Pictures, and I had more than 3,000 meetings where writers, directors, and stars would try and persuade me to buy their ideas. And I was on the executive team who purchased and supervised all of the studio films with budgets that ranged from $15 million to about $150 million. And in my 3,000 meetings with the top idea sellers in Hollywood, I learned what works and what doesn't, and I developed a system for helping people with good ideas get the attention and financing they deserve.
So, but you've left Hollywood, which I thought, that seems sort of a glamorous job. Why would you give that up to do this?
Well, it is a dream job, but I think it's someone else's dream job. And for me, the part of my job that I loved when I was a studio executive was working with creative people who had good ideas and helping them sell them.
Yeah.
And I got very frustrated with the quality of movies that were being made, and I knew that there were good ideas out there that just weren't being purchased because they weren't being pitched well enough. And so I decided that I wanted to help those people who had the good ideas pitch them more effectively. And so that's when I decided to leave and start my own business doing exactly that. And my goal really is to help individual people who have good ideas, because I believe that when the quality ideas succeed, we all benefit, whether it's movies or anything else.
Right. And so you're not working with just Hollywood people any longer.
Correct. I still do work with Hollywood people, but I also have worked with people in financial services and insurance and marketing and retail and a wide variety of industries as well.
Okay. Early on in the book, you write, business is like high school. Why do you write that? What do you mean?
Well, I think that that is something that a lot of people, it may make them upset, but the same sort of clique mentality that applies in high school, fair or not, certainly applies in the business world. And simply, people work with people they like, they want to hire people who they like, and unfortunately, a lot of people like people who are like themselves.
Right. So, but is that sort of a definite delimiter? If you're not like the people you're pitching to, is that going to prevent you from getting your ideas across?
Absolutely not. But if you ignore it as a reality, then it could. So the thing that is most important is being able to establish a personal relationship and a sense of rapport with the person who you're meeting, which can absolutely happen if you're the polar opposite of that person, but you want to find ways that you do have common experiences or shared interests that you can have something to talk about that you do have in common, and you want that to be positive.
Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, because I think the word rapport shows up a lot in your book. It's probably, you know, if you were at the Amazon site or something, this would be one of those key words. And so it's obviously an important concept. So can you just talk about a little bit, a few sort of hot tips on how you can actually, you know, get rapport with somebody who doesn't seem to have anything in common with you?
Definitely. The rapport section of the meeting, which is whether you're meeting someone for the first time or the fifth time, is, I think, the most important. This is the phrase that other people call the small talk section. And this is where most people make mistakes. And the most common mistake that people make is they start talking business too soon. So what I recommend is taking time to start a personal connection. So warming up the room, asking that person some questions that demonstrate that you have done some research about them or that you understand where they're coming from, making the question specific and not generic, broad questions that they've been asked a million times before, or asking them, don't ask them anything that you could find on the internet or that you could find in the corporate papers about the company.
Right, so let them know you've done your homework.
Exactly.
My other question there, sort of related to that, is what about the weather? Should you talk about the weather? I mean, that's, I get into these rooms and then somebody, the first thing they say is, you know, isn't it a great day? And then you just think, oh, God, we're really stuck in the lower depths of small talk. And yet, or is this just something, just take the other person's lead?
I think it's fine to start with the weather. And then ideally you want to move on to something that is still personal, but not asking them something that's too revealing. If you have a genuine interest in the other person, they will be able to feel that, and that's something that I don't think can be faked or fudged.
Yeah.
That if you do have a genuine curiosity about them, they can't help but warm up to you. So if you can just approach the conversation as if you are genuinely caring about the other person and curious about who they are, what makes them tick, what is their day like, what are the projects that they're most interested in seeing happen this year, they are naturally going to be more interested in you and trust you.
Yeah, and which reminds me of I shouldn't go down this route, but a quote from the Jim Collins, somewhere I read something where one of his mentors at one point said to him, you know, Jim, I think you would be better off to be interested in people rather than try too hard to be interesting.
Which brilliant.
I thought it's a great thing. It's sort of that notion of so be interested, and I think anyone can do that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. I'm thinking of a quote. I don't know if you've seen. Oh gosh, I should look up his name. Randy. He's a professor at Carnegie Mellon who.
Oh, Randy Pausch. P-A-U-S-C-H or something?
Yes, Randy Pausch, exactly. He has a quote in his presentation where he talks about how one of his mentors took him aside when he was a young manager and was saying to him, basically, you know, it's really unfortunate that people perceive you, that they're misperceiving you as someone who has so many ideas but doesn't care about them. And I know that that's not true. And he just said, well, he said it much more eloquently than I'm saying it, but that it was so, so impactful for him to realize that people were misperceiving the way that his intention simply because he wasn't asking them questions or the way that he was interacting with them was impeding his ability to make a positive impression.
Right, but which is why we all need a mentor or good, honest friends, because most of us misperceive at least some of the situations we're in, right?
I think that is definitely true, and particularly when people have an idea that they're trying to sell or a project that they've been working on for a long time, those people are honestly the least prepared to be able to talk about their work in a way that is clear, simply because they have lost the ability to be objective about it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, exactly. They're so involved in their own thing, that's all they know anymore.
Exactly.
Interesting. Now, sort of on the flip side here, maybe, I don't know if it's actually the flip side, but you talk about confidence and you allow as sometimes you have to fake it, and which is a fine skill probably to learn, but it's also you can never be sure. But the other thing is you then learned a lot about confidence from a fortune cookie that read, if you're willing to die, it is easier to live, which you take to mean that if you're detached from the outcome of a meeting, that you're much more likely to succeed. And this somehow reminds me of our cool friend Steve Shapiro, who's written a book on that whole idea called Goal-Free Living.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, that was a fortune cookie that I got, and I don't know about you, but I think there is wisdom in the place where philosophy and sugar come together.
Okay.
the point was really to emphasize the value of detachment from outcomes, and I think paradoxically, if you are primarily focused on building the relationship and learning from your experience more than getting a particular result, you are so much more likely to achieve what you want in the long run versus someone who is only concerned with quick response outcomes.
Why is that? I mean, I guess it seems counterintuitive, but maybe it only seems counterintuitive to a society that's massively focused on goals day to day.
I think you might be right. I wish I had the magical, metaphysical, spiritual answer for why that is true.
Well, if you're working with clients and you say to them, now, listen, go in there and you need to be detached from the outcome, is that something that your clients can absorb and deal with, or is that a difficult concept for them to get?
It's more about deciding what is a reasonable goal for the meeting. And often the goal for the meeting may simply be, I want to learn as much as I can about this person, or I would like to learn 3 things about this company or about myself in this meeting, instead of saying, oh, I want to sell this project for $10 million. And so it's simply just adjusting the way that you approach the meeting, and often it's simply in that small adjustment and how the person is framing the way that they approach the meeting that suddenly the world opens up to them.
Okay. And I just want to throw in here, this is a great book. It's got so much stuff to learn and do and lists and things to work on. I'm very impressed.
Well, thank you.
But now one thing, I think you've run into our leader, Tom Peters, somewhere along the line, or you were in a workshop with Tom and L.J. Rose, who was a facilitator with the Tom Peters Company?
That is correct. Tom came and spoke to the MGM corporate retreat at the Mansions in Las Vegas.
So did you guys sort of like do a brand you kind of, or was Tom just speaking to you?
Tom was speaking, but there was also some interactive elements after he spoke and got everybody fired up and charged up and conflicted, you could say.
That's good. Excellent. That sounds successful. But I don't know where to begin this question. You have this notion of the elevator pitch, which you say is a myth, and I know that the elevator pitch is one of the columns of this WOW project idea that Thomas Bowser, you know, if you do a WOW project workshop, you learn how to do the elevator pitch, which is if you get in on the first floor with your boss and trying to sell the idea, you want to sell it by the time you get to the 35th floor. You say the elevator pitch is a myth. Why is that?
I think the term elevator pitch incorrectly implies that it's appropriate to pitch in an elevator that basically communicating quickly and concisely is important, but you should never pitch when you don't have time to continue the conversation. A moment's access with someone who doesn't know you is not an opportunity. And for me, your first interaction with someone sets the stage for the relationship to come, and you shouldn't jump in and start pitching your idea to someone before they know who you are enough to care about what you're saying in the first place. And the third reason is that high-level buyers are pitched all the time, and they know when they are hearing something that's been repeated to dozens of other people. And if you haven't taken the time to build rapport and customize your pitch to that person's specific needs, it's a sign that you're an amateur, and every buyer is unique, and your pitch should reflect that.
Excellent. So there was that word rapport again. So actually you would say if you're in the elevator and you happen to get an audience with this person that you want to pitch, that's the perfect time to just say nice day or how are the kids or something to get a conversation going.
Yes, and not to bring up your pitch at all in that situation, because if you care about your project and you've been working hard on it, you would be foolish to share your great idea right there in that situation where they don't have the chance to carry on the conversation or be able to say yes to you. It's not the right situation.
Right. I think a lot of people need to hear your message, Stephanie, anyway, because you see this going on all the time. You see it at Starbucks or just walking down the street or I don't know where, or, you know, people obviously hustling a sale, and then you just see the other person sort of looking at them like, what are you doing, right?
Yes, and I think I may be particularly sensitive to this, living and working in Hollywood, where studio buyer, I was pitched in yoga, I was pitched at the dentist office, a woman followed me into the ladies' restroom. I mean, completely inappropriate situation.
Did you just say enough? Enough already?
I tried to be polite, but it was sort of like, honestly, do you really think this is the time where I'm going to be able to say, let me get my personal checkbook out and just write you a check?
Oh, God. Yes. Desperation. That's desperation.
Yes.
You also say that networking is a waste of time. Why is that?
Well, I think most people who use traditional networking techniques and believe that they're successful do so in spite of those techniques, not because of them. I think traditional networking is generally a quantity-based approach. The idea is if you meet enough people, you accumulate enough names, you will eventually find people who are a good fit.
Yeah.
And on the surface, this makes sense. You'd need a large pipeline of people because statistically only a few of them would be a right fit for your business. Basically a bulk mail strategy, you know, send out a lot of letters and see what comes back.
Yeah.
But bulk mail is expendable, whereas we are not. And the bulk mail approach doesn't work so well in establishing genuine relationships because we only have so much time. So therefore, instead of spending small amounts of time with lots of people, I suggest spending more time with fewer people you choose more carefully, a quality-based approach. Upgrade from bulk mail to a handwritten letter with a first-class stamp.
Well, I noticed that notion. I mean, Tom Peters has been speaking for years about sending physical thank you notes, and I see this more and more, you know, whatever, in tips in various places around the web. Why do you think it's a reaction to email and to this digital age that a physical letter now carries sort of more weight than it ever did?
I completely agree. And I think that it is because we're bombarded by so many different messages. The deluge of email communication and even voicemail can sometimes be so overwhelming that the fact that someone actually wrote you a handwritten letter stands out simply because of the sheer numbers. I may get one or two handwritten notes maximum per day, but I get hundreds of emails, and I imagine that's the same for many other people.
Yeah.
So, and you know that there's really no replicating. That person took the time to write that note and sign it and send it to you, whereas anyone on their staff, of course, could be sending the emails or...
Well, that's an important idea, the time taking, I mean, that sort of honor, by doing a written thing, you're honoring the person you're sending it to, because we all realize how valuable time is these days, right?
Yes, and it's such a sign of respect, saying, you are worthy enough, or I want to thank you for the time that you've taken to spend with me or to interview me or meet with me, that I'm going to honor you by taking this 15 minutes just to write you this personal note.
Right, and something I'd never thought about, but which you mentioned, is if you write a thank you note and it's not in a business size envelope, you know, it's a 4x5, I don't know, something different than business, it will get put at the top of the mail list by some heavyweight assistant. And so you get to the top of the actual physical pile by doing that letter.
Exactly. Simply by having a handwritten note, it's going to be prioritized on the top, and also you have the benefit of the assistant may not know your relationship with the person, whether you're their best friend or a family member or something, so they are automatically going to put you at the top of the list because you've already taken the time to write the note.
Right, and then if you then call in to that assistant, he or she may well then remember your name from the return address on that thing.
Exactly.
As well, right?
Yes.
Cool. I love that. But in as much as you don't believe in sort of the standard group theory of networking, you do still have a network lab, where you have three classes of people, which are a little different, I think, than most people's A, B, and C list. Can you name your groups and explain
sure.
why you have them?
Well, for me, the lists of A, B, and C groups, I don't like that simply because I know that I don't want to be on anyone's C list, and I don't think that anyone else does either.
Yeah.
For me, my groups are good people to know, which are anybody who I think for any reason might be someone I would like to know in the future. So if it's someone who I've met at a conference or someone's introduced me or even a friend that I met at a barbecue, if I think, you know, that person's really interesting for whatever reason, business or personal, I'm going to include them in my good people to know. If I meet someone and I know that I have no interest in them, I'm not going to include them in my Rolodex or keep tabs on them. I think that that's sort of like being a relationship pack rat. And so I start right from the beginning. I'm not looking to have the world's largest network so that I can brag, oh, I have 10,000 people in my list. I want to be more focused. So my next group is actually, I call them the VIPs, and those are people who I would like to have a business relationship with, but maybe I don't know them, but I would like to, or they're my target list. And I think people need to have 20 people is the maximum that you can have in your VIP list. And then my last group and most important is the inner circle. And those are the people that are closest to you who support you professionally and personally. That and those are the relationships that I spend the most time nurturing. And that's been the support that's been the most valuable for me personally and professionally.
You have your family in your inner circle, which I don't know. I've never thought of including. But so I like that idea. Why is it important to include your family in your inner circle?
Well, I think not everybody. Everyone's families are different, certainly. So by no means would everyone include their family in their inner circle, because I think the standard is actually quite high for who should be in that group. I think that they should know the real you and that you should care about them and that the feeling should be mutual and that you're not in competition with each other and that you can trust them to keep your confidence. I'm lucky enough that in my family, that my immediate family lives up to those categories, but certainly not everyone in my extended family does, nor, and certainly I know people for whom, you know, their family wouldn't,
yeah,
you know, unfortunately, live up to that high bar, since relationships are complicated.
Yeah, well, but generally, blood is thicker than water, as they say.
Yes, I agree.
Not always.
Yes, but certainly not 100% of the time.
But now, this reminds, what about LinkedIn, or what about other various, you know, digital social networking things? Any thoughts on those places?
I have mixed feelings. I have seen, generally, I think it can be fun if they are interested in communicating that way and they like keeping their network that way. Certainly, I have friends who I only communicate with on MySpace because that's the way that they like to communicate. So
yeah,
it's more a way of making it easy on the other person and communicating in their style. But for me, and I think that there are some effective ways to use social networking sites, but generally I'm so much more of a fan of having the person-to-person, face-to-face, phone call interactions more than I'm trying to accumulate large numbers in my LinkedIn profile.
But speaking of phone calls, you talk about, you have this notion of mini meetings. I mean, in a way, I don't know where to begin about this because you've such an anthropologist of the meeting and you've sort of diced and sliced it in so many ways. But even after you've had a meeting or before you have a meeting, it's like, I think in your world, you're always in a meeting,
which I mean
as a compliment, but that you're always thinking about what it means, or when you're communicating with people, or, you know, you're trying to get something or you're trying to help somebody else get something. I mean, so you have this notion of the mini meetings, which is, I mean, anytime you take a phone call or any little email that you're, when you're communicating, it's important to think of that as a meeting, which I like. Can you expand on that notion a bit?
Sure. I think that so often we dismiss those small interactions with people, but these are sometimes some of the most impactful ways that decision makers are determining whether they're interested in us or not, whether they want to continue a relationship, whether they want to recommend us to someone else. These pieces of communication are just as important as the actual in-person meeting. And I have four different, because there's a gazillion different kinds of mini meetings, I've narrowed it down to four main categories of mini meetings, which are making requests, keeping in touch, following up, and saying no. And those are the four areas that most mini meetings fall into those areas, and they are things I personally have needed to learn, and that in using these techniques, I've just dramatically been able to improve the responses that I've gotten to my own requests, but also my clients have been able to use these techniques with much greater chances of success.
Speaking of no, well, I hate to admit this, but I have Esquire magazine here, which I know I'm too old for it now, but I do like it because they have this column called What I've Learned, which sometimes is interesting.
Uh-huh.
But there is one of the articles this month is by this guy, and it's about saying no, about sort of really learning how to say no and no without any apologies. He just, like, it sounds like he spends a week of his life just when somebody asks him something, saying no. And like to his kids, it always used to be no, and this is the reason because of this and that, but now he's just saying no. And there's something kind of liberating for him in being able to do this. And I'm just wondering when did you realize you needed to learn to say no?
This has been, for me, the most important thing that I have learned since I became an entrepreneur. When I worked at the studio, I didn't really learn how to do this enough. And it wasn't until I was on my own that I really learned the value of I needed to learn how to say no. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to have a successful business. And I didn't learn it, so I wish that I knew more when I was at the studio, because I did such crazy things as one time I even drove a script to a strip club at 3 a.m. because my boss had called in the middle of the night, and things like that were tasks that I should have said no to, but I just didn't think I could.
Yeah.
It felt like, oh, I have to be able to say yes, otherwise I will lose my job, or I had all these other notions of why I couldn't possibly say no, when the reality is there were many ways I could have said no if I had just learned them earlier. So.
Interesting.
This is something for me that has just made, it has opened up so much more space in my day and in my professional life to be able to focus on the areas that I want to focus on instead of being weighed down by tasks that other people should be doing that aren't appropriate, that I felt out of guilt I should be doing rather than something that I actually wanted to do.
Yeah. I would think everybody has a tough time with that, but in a way, learning to say no, you really have to learn what it is you want to do most.
True,
right?
And it's really saying, you're saying no, but it's because you're saying yes to yourself. I'm saying no, I don't want to go to this, my friend's event of some kind, because I want to have a personal night to myself to spend with my husband, or I want to read this book that I've really been waiting to read. And that's very empowering when you can decide what it is that you want and then create that for yourself.
Okay, and one last question is about, I think it's your chapter 39, which is titled, Read This Chapter When You Get Stuck. I'm wondering, why is this chapter in this book?
This chapter is in the book for all of the artists who are out there and creative people who struggle to get their ideas heard. And it's from my experience, particularly in the last 3 years, where I've had this incredible privilege to work with a number of Academy Award-winning and Emmy Award-winning writers and directors who we might think would be at the very top of their profession and not struggle with any of these issues because, oh, they've produced 10 movies that we've seen and loved. They must be so confident and not struggle with writer's block or any of these issues. But they still do. So this is my message basically to all the people at whatever level who are struggling with a project and recognizing that being stuck is actually a great part of the creative process. And not a negative, but an opportunity to really get more of an understanding of where the stuckness is coming from. It is there for a reason, and so often the best ideas come out of trying to crack through that period of stuckness.
Okay, but now, so does this chapter then become the basis of your next book?
Well, what a good idea, Eric.
just trying to stay ahead of the curve here.
I'm not sure, but that would be a lot of fun, I think.
So thank you.
Sure thing.